Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And the Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. From WFIU, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
So for me, food is life. You know, it brings people together, but it has often been used to tear people apart.
On today's show, we talk with Suzanne Babb, an urban farmer in New York's South Bronx. We talk about her work with La Finca del Sur and discuss some of the barriers women of color face when it comes to growing food. We also have a piece featuring a StoryCorps conversation about women in farming across generations. And we have some interesting adult beverages from Chef Daniel Orr. That's all just ahead.
Hi, Kate. I've only got one news story for you this week, but it's a doozy. You're probably going to need a drink afterward.
Uh-oh. Do I really want to hear it?
Probably not. No, it's fine. It's actually not as bad as it sounds. Nutrition research is complicated. New research has challenged the oft-repeated notion that a glass of wine or two per day can be beneficial. Researchers working with the Global Burden of Diseases Project at the University of Washington say the risks of alcohol do not outweigh the benefits, by a long shot. The paper, published last week in the Lancet Medical Journal, looked at data on alcohol use from 195 countries from 1990 to 2016. The study said health risks from drinking include cancer, tuberculosis, driving accidents, and self-harm. The authors conclude with a dire warning. Our results show that the safest level of drinking is none. But critics said the claim that no amount of alcohol is safe has distracted from the more pressing dangers of excessive drinking. They point out that the health risk of one or two drinks a day is extremely low. According to the study, having one drink a day only increases your risk of developing an alcohol-related health problem by 0.5%. For two drinks a day, that risk goes up by another 6%. So what's the conclusion? Alcohol is not good for us. But odds are, one drink isn't going to kill you.
Okay, Alex. Thanks for clarifying.
Sure thing, Kate. And thanks to Chad Bouchard for that report.
Denise O'Brien and Kate Edwards' identities revolve around the American farm. They've both experienced the difficulties of farm life and draw inspiration from each other. Producer Cole Stinson brings us this piece from an interview provided by StoryCorps.
All of the food we eat and much of the clothing we wear comes from plants and animals that are raised on farms.
The small working farmer earns his living on the land. He works the soil to feed and clothe this country.
I get a kick out of everything that grows out of the ground.
And on the eighth day, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, I need a caretaker. So God made a farmer.
At beautiful Hilltop Farm, Mr. Clark raises only purebred hogs.
My first memory of you was when I was in college at Iowa State University, probably over a decade ago now. And you were running for Secretary of Ag of Iowa. And I was a young woman who was just enamored with that there was a woman farmer that could run for office. You were wearing a brown suit, and it was hot. And I remember thinking, that would be hard to be going around and meeting people. And I remember shaking your hand and just being so so amazed that someone could be running for office and be a farmer and be a woman. I think at that moment I was like, I want to be Secretary of Ag someday. My name is Kate Edwards, and I'm getting to talk to Denise, my friend.
I didn't grow up in a farm, so when I met Larry and he said he wanted to be an organic farmer, I'd been living out of the state, and I came back for a family wedding, and met Larry at the local bar, and, and he told me he was going to be an organic farmer. I learned to farm from him. I learned to drive a tractor. I learned to fix equipment. I learned about the language of farming, which really set me up for my life for the rest of my career, because it is a special language.
Yeah, it's a different vocabulary.
Yeah, the 2 years that I sort of went through this apprenticeship then prepared me for what happened in the 80s, which was an unknown. Nothing. We didn't know that there was going to be a farm crisis.
The farm crisis was the result of a confluence of many things. Failed policy, mountains of debt, land and commodity price booms and busts. And add two droughts, one in 1983 and the other in 1988. Farmers who were in the wrong place at the wrong time were crushed.
The two of us made a decision together one afternoon that we needed to do something because people were losing their farms. So we came to a mutual agreement that he would stay home and raise the kids and milk the cows, and I would do that when I was home, but I would also be on the road doing things. And so some of my first meetings were with our daughter, who was 6 months old, and I'd be sitting at the back of the room nursing her while, you know, we were doing meetings and learning, again, the language of what the farm crisis was about.
I was born in 86, which is the year the farm crisis ended. Both my parents grew up on farms, and they didn't return to the farm because of the 80s. I grew up thinking, oh my gosh, I wish I'd grown up on a farm. And I remember from a very young age knowing that my grandparents almost lost their farm. And they didn't. And there's a lot of people that did. And then I remember hearing about the suicides and the murders. And even though I wasn't around for it, I feel like I was because I know the stories. You know, I know it affected the way our family looks at things, the way we look at money, the way we look at land, the way we look at work. So I grew up thinking, I want to do something for farming. But because of the kind of patriarchal nature of the agricultural influence, I didn't necessarily think I could be a farmer, but I knew that I wanted to advocate on behalf of farmers. And so I remember I was 8 years old sitting at our kitchen table, you know, the same kitchen table that was my great-grandfather's kitchen table that had the notch in the edge where the tobacco had been cut on the one side, and sitting there thinking, I want to do something to change agriculture.
What set me up for the rest of my life as a woman farmer and an organizer and, you know, a founder of a women's organization was that I found out that women didn't identify themselves as farmers.
And oh, I know. My grandma still to this day calls herself a farm wife. Yes. And she milked the cows. She raised hogs on her own. She did all these things that doesn't count herself as a farmer. And that's so, even today, that's so prevalent in Iowa.
Exactly.
The women doing the work of the farm, calling themselves farm wives.
Right. And so people, as you said, that I stood up at this crowd and said I was a farmer. And I got used to that. I felt after the 2 years of apprenticeship with my husband that I could call myself a farmer.
Did that shock people?
Yes. Well, that's it. The people would,
because I still get shocked when I tell them I'm a farmer.
Yeah.
And they still are like,
yeah, it's a long ways to go yet to change that image of a male farmer. On the other end of the spectrum, young women would come up to me, and similar to your experience, and when I address a college audience or whatever, and they'd say, wow, you call yourself a farmer. And so, you know, that really.
Well, I really think you doing that and other women doing that really paved the way for women like me to just be able to do that.
Be comfortable with
Be comfortable with that.
Yeah. Well, Kate, I think it's interesting that you're still experiencing that we haven't, you know, changed.
Well, I get called a gardener all the time.
Gardener,
yes. And I tell people that my 1 acre of vegetables is 400 times the size of a garden. And I have, right now, next year I'll have 9 acres of vegetables. So, you know, that's almost 4,000 times the size of a garden. I'm not a gardener. I'm a farmer.
You are a farmer. We really didn't have role models. You know, Larry and I didn't with our farm, with organic farming, nor did I as a woman farmer. We had to create that. And I think that's been very strong with me, is having to be this role model for women to know that they can do, you know, this sort of work.
Being a woman farmer has its challenges in and of itself. Learning to farm itself is a challenge. And learning to know what one's voice is in the larger conversation that's happening about agriculture is also a challenge. And so I feel so privileged as a young woman in farming to have kind of this symphony of mentors around me.
This interview is provided by StoryCorps, a national nonprofit whose mission is to preserve and share humanity's stories in order to build connections between people and create a more just and compassionate world. StoryCorps.org. This recording is part of research led by the Indiana University Ostrom Workshop. Their study involves farm transitions from one generation to the next, in particular, transitions between people who are not in the same family. Find out more on our website, eartheats.org. We have a couple of drink ideas for you. And given the research on alcohol we mentioned earlier, they're both alcohol-free. This one works for summer or fall. It'll carry you from these two hot days into the cool nights ahead. I recorded this one with Chef Daniel Orr out at his mom's place near Columbus, Indiana, where they have an extensive herb garden.
Kate, I'm going to take you out to the herb garden. We are going to pick some sage today. This is a great summer beverage to be drank chilled, but it's even more wonderful in the winter. When it's cold outside, you can make this apple and sage elixir. So today what we're gonna do is we're gonna take some apple juice, bring it to a boil, drop the sage in it, and let it stew in there for a little bit. In the garden here, we've got several different kinds of sage. We've got two different variegated sages. We've got a purple sage, and then we've got just the regular broadleaf sage. Now you can be creative. You can add some ginger. You could also add some turmeric if you want, if you have fresh turmeric. You could add, especially in the winter, you could add some cinnamon sticks or cloves or some crushed nutmeg. And then let it steep there for about 10 to 15 minutes. Now if you're going to drink it in the winter, you want it hot, you can drink it right away. If you're going to drink it cool, you're just going to let it steep there and let it cool down to room temperature, like we've done here. And I also put a few black peppercorns. So I'm going to strain this off. And we're just going to have that with a slice of lemon on the rocks. And we've got a wonderful apple cider and sage elixir that you can serve all year round. And it goes well with food. If you want to cut down on your alcohol consumption, this is just as kind of nuanced and sophisticated as a glass of wine.
You can decide that for yourself when you sample this drink at home. You'll find the recipe, as always, at eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world, offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. This next drink idea features the deep, earthy flavors of dandelion root. It's a nice departure from some of the sweeter options offered when you're avoiding alcohol.
We're going to make some dandelion tea, and this is going to be an iced tea. So you go out there and you look at all those little yellow flowers, and you pull up those plants, especially after a nice heavy rain. And you can get the roots nice and long, wash them super well, and then either dry them just room temperature, you can put them in a dehydrator. Then, once they're dried, what you want to do is to bring some water to the boil, and then you're going to drop those in there. Now then, to make it taste more refreshing, I add some ginger. So slice up, maybe 2 or 3 tablespoons of ginger root, just real thin slices. Then on top of that, after it's been sitting there for 3 or 4 minutes, I throw in some fresh dandelion leaves. And you just tear those up, toss those in there. I'm going to add some mint. And then finally, I've got some lemongrass. And lemongrass, you have to kind of twist it around a little bit. All right, so we've added all those herbs to our dandelion and ginger. And we're just going to let that sit for at least 4 minutes. And if I take a spoon and I give it a little taste, it's going to be a little bit bitter because dandelion is bitter. So we're going to balance that out with some agave. You could use honey. You could use sugar. Strain that mixture into a lovely glass pitcher and serve that on the rocks. That does have a bit of bitterness, but I think it balances out nicely. You taste that kind of lemony flavor from the lemongrass, and it's a really balanced adult beverage, a non-alcoholic adult beverage.
If you didn't catch all that, just look up the recipe at eartheats.org. Our next guest, Suzanne Babb, works with Why Hunger in New York City. In her role as the Community Partnership Manager, she connects and supports organizations around the country dealing with food access. Her focus is the intersection of hunger, health, and poverty. She spends her time cultivating dialogue around the systematic inequalities that cause hunger and poverty. But we're speaking with her today about another role she plays in her community.
I'm Suzanne Babb, and I am an urban farmer in the Bronx. The farm that I'm a part of is called La Finca del Sur, and it's in the South Bronx, and the South Bronx is one of the poorest congressional districts in the U.S.
The term food desert might come to mind when you think about a place like the South Bronx, but urban farmers like Suzanne Babb would urge you to consider another term, food apartheid. Food desert makes it sound like it's naturally occurring. But those who work in the world of food access and food justice know the policies and practices that lead to neighborhoods without readily available fresh foods. La Finca del Sur is connected to a movement that gives voice to communities denied access to nourishing food.
It's a women of color-led farm, mainly Black and Latinx women, who are working towards food justice in their community. It was founded in 2009, and I've been farming there for 6 years. The name La Finca del Sur translates to Farm of the South, and it's called that because we're in the South Bronx, but also because most of us have roots either in the American South or in the global South, whether that's Africa, the Caribbean, or Central and South America. And also recognizing, too, that as women who are farming here, we're in solidarity with the women who are the majority of farmers in the global South. It's about 4 acres, and we farm on 2 of those acres. We have about 20 member beds that people pay a certain amount of money each year, and they can grow whatever they want in that bed for the whole year. And then we have communal beds, which we grow food for the South Bronx Farmers Market, which started about 4 years ago. And we're like the only urban farm that sells at that market. We sell a lot of greens like collards, Swiss chard, kale. We sell dandelion leaves. We have carrots and beets and strawberries. And we're trying to grow sweet potato this year. We have epazote and papalo and different types of tomatoes and cucumbers. And we grow a lot of herbs. So we've got like lemon balm and mint and sage and parsley and cilantro, oregano, thyme, peas and beans as well. We grow to sell, but also grow those for like nitrogen fixing, squash. Yeah, I think that's it.
But growing food is only one part of the work at La Finca del Sur.
So I would say that the work that we do is kind of split into 3 categories. There's the food production part and the food justice part. And we really try to connect. We connect with like Bronx Greenups, which helps support community gardens around the borough. When we work with other folks, we hold workshops around food and farming techniques for community gardeners. And the second part, I would say, is around women's healing. and creative expression. So we've had everything from like all day retreats where we've had yoga and meditation. We've done murals. We do all kinds of things that women want to and need to do to kind of heal from the everyday living existence of and what we face as women of color. And then the third thing I would say is around social justice. So really connecting to what's going on in other parts of the Bronx and other parts of the city that are connected to food as well. So we have done things with folks who are working around gentrification and trying to make sure that housing stays affordable to the Bronx. We've had talks there. We've done things with Latino Outdoors, which is a group that is really trying to reconnect folks who identify as part of the Latinx community back to nature and the outdoors. And last year we had a whole day of programming with BUFU, which is By Us For Us, which is really working to build Black and Asian solidarity. And so just having a whole day of like conversations and activities to really build that collaboration.
I asked Suzanne what motivates her to do this work.
I think initially, for me, I came from it from a health perspective, but more like nutrition, you know, and teaching people how to cook, which I still think is very important. But I think what I have realized in the years of being at the farm and other work around food is that, like, food is the linchpin of culture and community. I feel like working in the farm brings back food memories for folks. And like for me, I know that it has brought back my connection, my family's connection to food. Like my father grew up on a farm and had to come to, I'm from Canada, and he came to Canada as a migrant farm worker, even though he was trained as a mechanic. But that was one of the only ways that he could immigrate. And had to, like, the second year that he did that, had to, like, leave the farm in the middle of the night to go to another city to try and get a different life. And so I think about how that's tied to migration and immigration. And also my grandfather on my mother's side was a sugarcane cutter. And that's, like, my grandparents died when I was pretty young. And that's the only memory I have is my grandfather taking my sister and I to a sugarcane field and us tasting sugarcane for the first time. And so like having that food connection being the only connection to my most recent ancestors, it builds community. I feel like when you're farming like in a city, people often just worry about whether a farm can feed people to a scale that it needs to. But for me, it's you get so much more. You're more in tune with the environment because you have to know what your plants need. You're more in tune with the people around you. You have to be more engaged in what's happening politically because you're trying to preserve the land that you're growing on, which you often don't own. You get more in a space that I'm in, you're more in touch with your culture and other people's culture, and you're learning in this like popular education informal way that is much deeper and like celebrates everybody as experts. So for me, food is life. You know, it brings people together, but it has often been used to tear people apart.
What do you think are some of the barriers that keep people of color from being involved in farming or growing food, and in particular women of color maybe?
Well, I think there's the history of farming, of agriculture, of how people of color have been used and exploited through chattel slavery to work this land. I mean, it's one of the reasons that I know that Africans were kidnapped and brought into slavery here is because of our knowledge of that. But the history that is closest to us is that of slavery and that of sharecropping and how we were exploited and tortured. And that's often the only part of our history and our connection to agriculture that we know of and hear about. So that is really painful. And so I know for my family and other people's families, success for their children meant going to school, getting a college education, and getting an office job. But I think that through my work at La Finca, and then I'm also part of a group called Black Urban Growers, which is all of these growers around the country, urban and rural, who are connected to that liberatory history around agriculture. So talking about the ways in which like farmers often were like the pillars of the civil rights movement. You know, they would sometimes sell their land to help fund the civil rights movement, or when people were marching from place to place, would give them a place to stay and food to eat to keep them keep their work going. To like Fannie Lou Hamer, who had the Freedom Farm Collective, that was this acres of farm that people worked collaboratively and sent food all the way up to Chicago and had a health clinic and had a sewing cooperative and all of these different ways in which people used the land for self-determination. We need to reclaim the narrative so that folks understand that, like, yes, we come from this painful history, and we have also had some liberatory, we have a liberatory history that we need to celebrate. And that is why I think most of the folks who farm now farm, because being able to grow your own food is freedom. Like, I think Fannie Lou Hamer said, it was like, I've got jars of food pickled and canned, and if I've got that, nobody can tell me what to do. And so once we connect to that and realize that that's, those skills and those practices give us our freedom so that we can do those other things and organize in other ways, and we're still able to take care of our basic needs.
You've been listening to a conversation with Suzanne Babb about her work with La Finca del Sur, a farm in the South Bronx led by women of color.
Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
I spoke with Suzanne at the Allied Media Conference in Detroit in June. For more information about the farm, see our website, eartheats.org. That does it for our show this week. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to Earth Eats wherever you get your podcasts. That way, you'll never miss an episode. And follow us on Twitter, @EarthEats. Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step, New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world, offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. Earth Eats happens because of Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Cole Stinson, Allison Quance, Julia DeBrugger-Valiant, Kate Edwards, Denise O'Brien, and Suzanne Babb. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and we'll see you next time.